This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, for many years, poet Alan Shapiro has written about relationships, family memories, memories of marital strain, what you would call domestic subjects. But his 12th book of poetry reflects on a different passion, his new love of science, physics, astronomy, biology, evolution, anything that evokes a sense of wonder. His new volume titled Real to Real. Alan Shapiro is a poet and professor of English and creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he joins us now. Alan, welcome back.
Great to be here, Frank.
It's been too long.
Yeah.
And but great. And this is your 12th volume.
Yes.
So no excuses. We should have you back more often. Mm-hmm. So when did you discover science? It's been out there a long time. You
know. I know it's been out there a long time. The math scared me off when I was younger.
Yeah.
But it's actually kind of a shaggy dog story. My friend and colleague Daniel Wallace, the great novelist, was being considered for an appointment for a professorship at UNC, this was, I don't know when this was, 2004, maybe 2005, mm-hmm. Maybe earlier than that, and we created this position for him, which he accepted, and then the administration of the university discovered that he didn't have a BA. He had never graduated college, and we couldn't hire somebody who didn't have a BA. So Daniel
Wallace
had to go back to school.
His book becomes a film. BA. Okay.
But he didn't have a BA.
Okay.
And so he took biology, and he took math. And another friend of ours, scientist in his own right and businessman, Neil Patterson, thought this would be a great opportunity if Daniel and I met with E.O. Wilson and Steven Pinker, and he filmed a conversation between us. And we thought, man, that's great. And so he gave me a reading list of books on science because I had read nothing. And of course, Daniel was taking biology and acing both classes, I should say. He did really well in those classes. He knuckled down. And the filmed conversation that Neil was going to use, as a kind of educational documentary never came off, but I got so interested in the reading that I never stopped. Daniel graduated and now teaches at UNC, and I don't think he's read a science book since then, but I have continued to do it. And it's just, as you mentioned, it is much more of a source of wonder for me than, say, organized religion has ever been, because organized religion seems all about coming up with answers to fundamental questions, and science is really only interested in coming up with questions to questions, and whatever answers they come up with are always tentative and refutable.
Well, there are those who would say that when done well, both religion and science should be about the same
thing.
They have acolytes who, in the third and fourth generations,
right,
turned it into an industry. But
right.
But anyway,
right.
I won't quibble because I take
that.
Your point.
Yeah.
Your point. So tell us about the thread that runs through Real to Real.
I think there are still some of my old concerns in this book of love and the importance of human bonds and the fragility of those bonds. Those human experiences are put in the context of a larger world, not just a social world or a political world, but a natural world, a cosmological world. Are explored in relationship to the very large, to the infinitely large, and to the infinitely small.
And it seems to me, as I read these poems, that one of the things that was certainly one of the things you evoke from me as I read these poems is the fragility of our own minds and the mm-hmm. way we structure this reality. The big wide world out there could be what it is, but we got to squeeze it into our heads and tell ourselves a little tiny story.
Right, exactly. And that story will die with us, and in a way, taking a larger perspective can put in perspective some of the perennial concerns that seem so important to us at a particular moment, and like war and the justification for war. There's a lot of poems in this book about the Iraq War, and I explore that in relationship to some of the iconic texts of Western tradition, like the Iliad, for instance. And so So, it, you know, it, the poems move, I guess, are interested in history in the broadest sense, you know, literary history, social history, natural history, history of the universe, and how all of those somehow intersect.
Will you read one for us now?
Sure. I'll read the first poem in the book. It's called Wherever My Dead Go When I'm Not Remembering Them. And just as a quick background, I'd been reading the neurosciences account for memory and consciousness, which is strictly materialistic, strictly explains consciousness in terms of electrochemical activity in the brain. And that may be true of the material substrate of consciousness, but it's not what consciousness feels like. And then in a way, that's what poetry is. It's an effective language, and it's an attempt to explore the emotional implications of ideas. And so this is about memory and about where the people that we've lost are when we're not actively remembering them. And it's cast about for metaphors for that. So here's the wherever my dead go when I'm not remembering them. Not gone, not here, a fern trace in the stone of living tissue it can somehow flourish from, or the dried up channel and the absent current. Or maybe it's like a subway passenger on a platform in a dim-lit station late at night between trains after the trains have stopped. Ahead, only the faintest rumbling of the last one disappearing. And behind the dark, you're looking down for any hint of light. Where is it? Why won't it come? You wandering now along the yellow line, restless, not knowing who you are or even where until you see it. There it is, approaching, and you hurry to the spot you don't know how you know is marked for you and you alone as the door slides open into your being once again, my father, my sister or brother, as if nothing's changed, as if to be known were the destination. Where are we going? What are we doing here? You don't ask. You don't notice the blur of stations we're racing past. The others out there watching in the dim light, baffled, who for a moment thought the train was theirs.
Alan Shapiro reading his poem, Wherever My Dead Go When I'm Not Remembering Them, from his latest volume of poetry called Reel to Reel. When I read that poem, what came to mind was that, so then I started asking myself questions. I said, well, where are they when they're alive and I'm not remembering them? Can they be? Are you still, you know, my mother? Yeah. If I'm not remembering you. I mean, it's a bit of the tree falling in the forest, but it really does call to question sort of how we frame things and how important our own consciousness is.
Absolutely.
To making things real.
And what it leaves out.
Did this scare you when you took on science as a poet, as someone who thought deeply about these things without that kind of scientific knowledge?
No. I was basically reading in a very predatorial way. I was looking for metaphors, hunting for metaphors, and it was just a goldmine of them. So, excuse me, it was exciting and fun, and again, I was surprised at how much of it I could understand, because it said when I was younger, I was so put off by the math. Right. And whatever little experience I had of it in high school and grade school, I was totally baffled, and now even the math isn't all that hard. It's not easy, but it's not as hard as I thought it would be.
Well, you know, back in the sort of the 16th century, those romantic poets were often scientists and deeply interested in it.
Yeah.
It was considered, science was considered an imaginative pursuit.
Yeah, right. Well, there wasn't even the word science. If you go back to the 16th century, it was natural philosophy.
Right. But it scares some people when they come to that conclusion. They've been living their lives merrily believing that what it is they perceive is, in fact, the fact of things. And then you come to this and say, oh, my goodness, perhaps I've just made it all up.
Yeah.
That can be, you know, create a kind of existential dread, make you not kind of want to get up. You remember that Woody Allen thing where he says he's not going to do his homework because he learned that the cosmos is going to collapse in 10 billion years, and so what's the point?
Yeah, right.
I mean, you didn't have that problem.
No, I, you know, it's a good question, because there is that, you know, there is that sense that the universe is both finite, you know, it's infinite and bounded and limited, and it will end at some point, which is sort of, but you know, those kinds of timescales, like, you know, 5 billion years, they don't have any reality, you know. Yeah. I mean, I sort of live from mortgage payment to mortgage payment, so, you know, I it doesn't mean anything, but it's very exciting, though, to think of, you know, when you think about just the sheer unlikeliness of life deriving from subatomic bits of matter that were born at the Big Bang. It's just a mind-boggling notion, and that it would, you know, that it would be that matter would be forged in the heart of some, over millions of years in the heart of some primordial sun that would explode and reconfigure by virtue of gravity, whatever that is, you know, into this solar system, this Earth circling this sun at just the right distance for that matter to warm up enough but not get scalded to come alive.
Of course, the point is that this experiment's happening 10 billion times in only one place it took,
right.
And you're here to notice
And we're here to notice it, exactly.
We should read another poem for us.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. This is a section from a longer poem about, it's called Homeric Turns, and it's one of the interesting things about theology and about is that everything that we might say about a God is really an indirect or oblique explanation of what it means to be human, because the qualities that define them as a God are obviously things that we lack. And what I love about the Greek mythology is that the gods are limitless beings who are profoundly obsessed with human beings. And they're obsessed with us because we are capable, by virtue of our limitations, we are capable of excellence. Whereas the gods, because they're not bounded by anything, can't do anything well because they can do everything well because they're not working against anything. It's like, you know, if you think about the god Apollo and LeBron James, compare the two, for instance. You know, when LeBron James leaps from the foul line and dunks the basketball, we think, wow, he just redefined what I thought was possible given the limits of the human body and the laws of physics. When Apollo leaps from the foul line and dunks the ball, you think, big deal, he's a god, you know. I mean, he can do whatever he wants. And that's what they love about us, and that's what concerns. So they're always mimicking us, but in ways just to see what it's like to be limited. Yeah. So this is a poem about a story that when Hephaestus, the god of welding, the god of the blacksmith, of Mount Olympus, when he was born as a cripple. And he was laughed at and mocked by the gods. And his mother, Hera, threw him out of heaven because he was just so offensive to her sight. And so it's about that. So here it is. The gods laugh. That's what they're good at, laughing. They laugh at the crippled god, his shriveled legs, his hobbling, and his mother in a little shadow play of suffering at the sight of him. Her crippled baby laughs the loudest and then laughs even louder when she hurls him out of heaven and he falls. And while he falls, the laughter echoing around him is the measure of the pure, unbreathable, cold height of the heaven he's falling from and through. Hilarity of light and air delights effacement of everything but itself. And the crippled baby tumbling to earth in a charade of terror? Don't let him deceive you. He's a god. He's laughing, too.
Alan Shapiro, reading from Real to Real on the State of Things. This is what the new volume is called, your 12th volume of poetry. Did you feel this is, I mean, you are saying, your blurbs say, I feel that this is a kind of departure from the stuff you've been writing. Did it feel different to you to write this volume?
Yeah, it did. It did. It felt different. On the other hand, the experience of writing it felt just the same, that it was fun and a kind of joyful act and an affirmative act, even if the poems have a kind of despair at the heart of them. There's something affirmative about just the act of writing. I mean, writing is a way, as I've said before, it's a way of being happy and a way of living an affirmative life in the presence of forces that might challenge that affirmation.
You know, I don't think there's any despair in these. You have the feeling that when you get to this notion that I'm making everything up, there's no reality, and you come to that moment, you as the poet might despair. But what the art does is give us a way of coping. And
sure,
saying, this
absolutely.
Is that there's meaning in this. So we're meaning makers. It's what we do.
That's
you know, and let's not disparage that. That's who we are.
That's it. And that, I guess that's the key point, is that, you know, the universe may not be meaningful, but it permits meaning. Mm-hmm. The universe may not be joyful, but it permits joy. And that's what art is. Art is about value and meaning. And science, I think, is about fact, establishing fact and refuting fact. But the act of science, the act of wondering, the act of living in the presence of mystery is an extremely powerful and valuable. And it seems to be, we seem to be the way the universe has decided to think about itself.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. Religion, science, and poetry at their best can allow the universe to be what it is, yes. Unconscious and amazing. And whenever you try to squeeze that in too tiny a box
exactly.
And say, I understand what God is, I understand
right.
How this subatomic particle, that's
right.
That's when you begin to reduce it all
that's
and
right.
It becomes either doggerel yeah. Or, yeah. Or dogma.
Yeah. Richard Feynman says that, the great scientist, physicist, said that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you do not understand quantum mechanics.
Alan Shapiro, always a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for inviting me.
I have to be here.
You have to be
they
here.
They actually pay me. They pay me for this.
Well, you may not know this, Frank, but I'm actually taking your place. This is my show.
The Alan Shapiro Show. Ladies and gentlemen, tune in every day at noon. Alan Shapiro, poet who wrote Reel to Reel, also an English and creative writing professor at UNC Chapel Hill. We've got images, we've got slideshows, and more information about Alan, all of it at our website, stateofthings.org, which is a program, as you know, produced by Laura Lee, Megan Mataferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. You may not know our intern as well, but he is Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.